Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. And we're here until 4 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke a little bit later on. We'll have a Blackhawks Express from last night, or from actually tonight's game, and much more. Dr. Karen Phillip is going to join us. Her new book is called Communication Harmony, and we'll talk to her. And we've got a whole bunch of other stuff happening this morning. But right now, it is time for the movie reviews, the Sunday night, Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me every week to talk about the new movies. We'll do box office as well. So let's welcome the guys here. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome.
Thanks.
Before we get to new movies, Eric, the Chicago Film Critic Association handed out their winners for this year.
We certainly did, and a lot of people seem to really enjoy the choices that we made. Parasite, Bong Joon-ho's Parasite, became the big winner of the night. Won best film, best director, best original screenplay, and best foreign language film.
Wow! All right, and then let's see what else. Best actor went to Adam Driver for Marriage Story. Best actress went to Lupita Nyong'o for Us.
Yeah, that was really, really fantastic.
Yeah, that's
I'm particularly happy with that one.
Yeah, she's fantastic in that movie. Best supporting actor, Brad Pitt for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Florence Pugh for Little Women, best supporting actress.
Yeah.
You mentioned original screenplay, went to Parasite. Adapted screenplay went to Greta Gerwig for Little Women.
Yep, one of four awards for Little Women.
And documentary went to Apollo 11. Best animated feature went to Toy Story 4. Best cinematography went to Roger Deakins. Does Roger Deakins just get it every year?
He should.
I mean, I agree. I mean, he's probably the best cinematographer alive right now. But
he's got some catching up to do, so it's fine. I mean, it's fine.
1917, best editing, Thelma Schumacher for The Irishman. You know why? Because she had to deal with so much footage.
Yeah.
Best art direction, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Best costume design, Little Women. Best original score, Alexandra Desplat for Little Women. Best use of visual effects, Ad Astra. Most promising performer, Aisling Franciosa for Franciosi for The Nightingale. And then the Milosh Award went to Lulu Wang for The Farewell. Tell everybody what the Milosh Award is. Milosh.
Yeah, this is an award. Milosh Celik, the founder of Facets, who passed away this past summer, who was such a champion of independent filmmakers and was always giving them, you know, a leg up wherever he possibly could. And when after he passed, you know, it just seemed appropriate that we wanted to honor him in some way. And since we've had a breakthrough filmmaker, breakthrough artist award for so many years, we felt it only appropriate that we name the award henceforth going forward after him. So Lulu Wang was the inaugural winner of the award for The Farewell, richly deserved, I thought.
Yeah, and Milosh was an amazing guy, and very, very important to the film scene in the city. You know, I mean, obviously Facets is a, you know, legendary place, and
We had Charles Coleman from Facets there last night to present the award. It was the first award we gave out of the evening.
Oh, that's nice. That's really cool. Okay, well, those are the awards right there. There's this, the Film Critics Association announced those awards, Parasite being the big winner. So there we go. All right, we got some movies to review here. Steve, why don't you start with Colwell?
Yeah, speaking of movies that probably wouldn't have gotten a shot in Chicago if it weren't for Facets, this is a sophomore effort from writer-director Tom Quinn, who did a movie a few years ago called The New York Parade, which also played at Facets. And it's exactly the kind of movie that's probably going to get lost in the shuffle of award season contenders and big-budget studio works that are out right now. But a recent pair of Film Independent Spirit Award nominations, including a much-deserved nod to Karen Allen, who's for lead actress, will hopefully get Colwell a little bit of attention that I think it richly deserves, and hopefully is an incentive for people to go check it out. Allen plays a woman named Nora, who is a veteran postmaster of a small post office in Colwell, Pennsylvania, which seems to be, I mean, the post office itself seems to be incorporated into her house, which is kind of wonderful, and it sort of gives you a sense of how homey the whole thing is. And for 35 years, she's gotten up early every day and fed and tended to the chickens in her backyard, and then goes through her sort of daily routine to open and run the post office for her mostly elderly customers. But this is obviously more than a job to Nora. It's sort of her primary social outlet, and people don't just come to, like, send and pick up mail. It's like an outpost where people gather, and there's, like, chairs and coffee and candy dishes and sort of all contributing to the sense of community. There's one woman who just shows up and knits all day. And it's sort of her about her sense of belonging, and clearly she thinks it's part of her job to set this up. And probably her best friend as a postal worker is another postal worker named Charles, who's played, as mentioned, Kevin J. O'Connor earlier. He stops by every morning, delivers supplies and any mail that needs distributing, and then they just, that's like her main conversation of the day is with him usually. And then one day Nora gets a letter from the regional headquarters informing her that the office is going to be closed and that her contract with the post office will not be renewed, at least not at that location. She's given the chance to reapply for another position in a larger office that's not very close, but for a woman in her late 60s with no car on a modest income, the idea of hopping on a bus every morning to a distant town does not seem like any kind of life she wants to live. And so slowly Nora starts to take stock in her life and how she got to Colwell in the first place, and starts to contemplate what loneliness might actually feel like. And Karen Allen is exquisite here and adds such a dignity and sort of quiet perfection to this character, while the people around her kind of cry foul at the post office and their decision, they worry about her and her future. It isn't until this news comes that we kind of start digging into Nora's history a little bit in the film. We get sort of glimpses of her past as sort of a free-spirited young woman hitchhiking around the country and sort of never taking root until she meets a very nice man and they settle down in this small town. The past doesn't really creep into the story until she starts. They don't really feel like regrets or anything like that, but at the same time, she's sort of remembering the last time she had this kind of freedom, and I think that's why the past is kind of creeping up, because it's been a while. And in her early 20s, it was kind of exciting to live an untethered life, but today the prospect is terrifying. And the movie kind of captures her, Nora's very small, contemplative life really beautifully. Some people may think she's a little too closed off, but others might look at her quiet existence and be very envious of it. So there's also these sort of strange interactions she has with a younger woman named Ella, who's played by Hannah Gross, who may or may not represent or even be the younger version of Nora. The film's kind of deliberately vague about this. So as a result of these conversations with Hannah, Nora begins to adjust to the idea that her life might have one more sort of unexpected chapter left to it. And the film kind of leaves a few things unresolved at the end, and that's fine. Like, that's kind of the way life is. And Colwell is a movie about reflection and the value we kind of place on work and ourselves as we get older. And I found it very deeply and profoundly and unexpectedly moving. And like I said at the beginning, I can't urge you enough to find a way to see this movie, if only to watch Karen Allen really in peak form. And it's playing at Facets through the end of the week.
Okay, and I had Kevin on the show on Friday to talk about it, and he's very proud of the movie, and
yeah,
he said he had a great time working with Karen Allen, and that she was just a real pro and just like really cool, so which is what you would expect. You know, she hasn't had a lot of leads.
No,
you know what I mean. Like this is really unusual that she's got, especially at this time in her life as she is growing older.
Yeah,
to get a nice big role like this, and
you got to give the filmmaker credit for even daring to write a movie about a woman at this age, like as the lead, because, and then just to cast someone like you said who doesn't have a lot of lead actress experience, but man, I mean, there was never a doubt in my mind she could handle it.
Oh, it's yeah, but
she's fantastic in this, like just genuinely honest and believable.
Yeah. Well, she's always been one of my favorites. I've always loved Karen Allen, always. And I mean, you know, first of all, I mean, as you guys know, she's Marion, for God's sake. And one of the greatest female characters, you know, in adventure movie history.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, she was in stuff like Shoot the Moon, which is, you know, one of my favorite movies of all time. Mm-hmm. And she's just been consistently great for all these years. And it's nice that she's got a nice big role like this. So,
yeah.
Okay, cool. All right. Well, why don't we take a quick break here? And when we come back, we'll jump into more movies. You guys hang out, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right, Eric and Steve are here. It's the Sunday night, Monday morning movie reviews. Colwell, by the way, is the movie we were just talking about with Karen Allen. It's playing at Facets. Highly recommended. So we'll talk more and review more movies right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 4 a.m. Dr. Karen Phillip is going to join us. Her new book is called Communication Harmony. We'll talk with her. And we're going to talk about the great career of Danny Aiello. We're going to talk about Halloween tradition or holiday traditions that probably should be retired. The best performances by actors followed by the worst performances by them. And stars of celebrities that can be spoiled. So there you go. That's all coming up on the show. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. Every week at this time, we talk about the movie reviews. It's Sunday night, Monday morning movie reviews. Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me every week, and then we'll talk about box office as well. Let's get the guys back in here. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right. Eric, tell us about Black Christmas.
Okay, well, this is the second remake of Bob Clark's 1974, really kind of seminal horror classic, Black Christmas. In this version, the setup is very similar. There is a college campus. There are women being murdered on it, and we are focused on a group of women from a sorority. The main one that we get to know is, her name is Riley, played by Imogen Poots, and she has a complicated past due to a rape that she suffered at the hands of one of the fraternity presidents. Even though no one seemed to believe her, he was nevertheless forced out of the fraternity. But, you know, things seem to be, might be coming back to haunt her now, as not only he comes back, but women are also, her fellow classmates, fellow sorority girls, are protesting treatment of women on campus, specifically Carrie Ellis's kind of misogynistic/Oleana-esque professor, who doesn't teach books about women, certainly has a misogynistic attitude about him, and there's petitions being brought about to force him out. And murders continue to happen, and Riley also discovers kind of sneaks in on a pledge ritual that is occurring involving the bust of the college's founder, who is sort of a notorious bad person, and a number of the pledges at the local fraternity are taking part in this ritual, and a mysterious black goo is dripping from the bust. Okay, so that's, you know, where we kind of get the title of Black Christmas for this current version. And while I was thinking about how to kind of best kind of sum up this movie after I had seen it, I thought of Toni Collette's line in Knives Out where she says to Daniel Craig that, "I saw a tweet about an article about a profile about you," because a lot of this movie kind of feels like one giant tweet in a way, that if you just sort of click on the tweet, that the, you know, all the sort of righteous anger, and in many cases justified and deserved anger, that you see regarding situations and treatment of women and, you know, sexual assault and all these kind of things that are occurring in real time out there, we nevertheless, you know, we've experienced that anger, but this movie, you know, really wants to put it at the forefront, and it's a really interesting way to go about it. However, the pacing of this movie is so off that it really does kind of disservice not just to the message, but also to the experience of wanting to see the sort of the comeuppance that whoever is responsible for these murders, you know, whatever they're going to get in the end, not the least of which this movie is rated PG-13, whether or not, you know, that's a debatable topic for another show, but everything just seems to be at a disservice. It takes a while before this movie really kind of kicks into high gear, more of an action mode, more than the horror mode that the original subscribed to. I think the women in from the sorority, with the exception of Imogen Poots, who I think is better in the second half of the movie more than the first half, are kind of all forgettable. They're not exactly very memorable, and a couple of them are not particularly great actresses. And it's a real shame, because this movie really kind of has its heart and its head in the right place. And I think when people, I've seen some people think that the last half or the last third of the movie kind of goes off the rails, but for me, that's, I think, where it at least kind of gets pretty interesting, even though it, you know, it drives home its message, you know, like a stake through the heart and a hammer to your head, and that, again, that's okay at times. You know, sometimes those messages need to be hammered into us, but you know, by the time you sort of get to the conclusion of this movie and everything's going to kind of bust loose, you know, I've seen better, you know, fight sequences done with much more skill. And I think that the failures of this movie, you know, really come from the direction. You know, Sofia Tikal's direction just doesn't, you know, she really wants to hammer home the points that the screenplay is trying to make, but it's kind of failing in the genre expectations that this, you know, that we're all going to see this movie for. So it's a real mixed bag for me. The second half is a bit better than the first half, but it's ultimately a no for me.
Okay. Why don't we wait, Steve, to get your review, because we have to we're going to break here in just a couple of minutes because Walter Jacobson's perspective is on the way. So we'll get your thoughts on it anyway. So it's not a Eric, it's not like a flat out remake of the Bob Clark movie. It doesn't sound like it.
Not entirely. No, it really takes a turn that I don't want to reveal too much about. I mean, you haven't seen the movie yet?
No.
Okay, I'm curious to see what your take on it is. I know how much you love the original movie. It's certainly better than the first remake.
Yeah.
Of the movie, which is kind of lives in infamy as all in it for its awfulness. But yeah, it kind of takes the setup and goes in its own direction, just doesn't quite make it there for me.
Yeah. I love the original Black Christmas. I love that movie. And I remember when the movie came out, I saw it at the Roosevelt Theater in the Loop when I was nine when it came out, because it came out in 1974.
Yeah.
And so I remember they had an 800 number that you could call and get an obscene call. So you could call. Are there obscene phone calls in this one?
No, there are obscene text messages.
Oh,
yeah, unfortunately, and you know, it's just, you know, people can kind of gather how I've been describing this movie, and there, you know, there's a whole contingent out there now talking about how horror films are getting too political nowadays. You know, if you go back to 1974's Black Christmas, that was 1 year after Roe versus Wade.
Yeah.
And the movie involves, you know, one of the women who's pregnant.
No, it's a big,
and being forced to have an abortion.
No, it's a big part of the movie. It's a major part of the movie.
Yeah, so you can't play that card. So it's not the fact that the movie is too political is the issue. It's just the way it kind of ultimately goes about it that I think ultimately kind of fails it.
Okay. All right, you guys hang on. We'll get Steve's Steve's view. You guys hold on a second. Eric and Steve are here, and we're going to get Steve's review of the remake of Black Christmas, the latest version of Black Christmas. That's coming up. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio here. And we're here till 4 a.m. It is Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We got a Blackhawks Express from the game earlier, which featured Patrick Kane getting a hat trick, and that'll be fun to listen to. We're also going to talk with Dr. Karen Phillip. Her latest book is called Communication Harmony, and she has a PhD in philosophy and sociology, and she specializes in relationships and parenting, and she's a really fascinating and great guest, so we'll have her on a little bit later on as well. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text if you want to join us. Steve Procopi, Eric Childress join me every Sunday night, Monday morning to talk about the Sunday night, Monday morning movie reviews. Let's get them back on. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
Okay, before the break, we heard Eric's thoughts on the latest black version of Black Christmas, which I guess every few years now we'll get another one. Steve, what do you make of Black Christmas?
Well, let me reiterate something that Eric said just at the end there, that anyone that complains that this new version of Black Christmas or any movie is perhaps too topical or political should have their horror fan membership card revoked, because horror and sci-fi has never been afraid to dive in head first into social commentary going back as far as like the late 50s. So the idea that a female filmmaker has made this film that isn't in the least bit afraid to tackle issues like toxic masculinity and rape culture on college campuses, the only surprise about it is that it's taken this long to do it. So, So just stow that, please, those criticisms. There's a really fascinating moment toward the beginning of the movie where these sorority girls perform at like a talent show at the fraternity where this assault happened, and you're just sitting there going, why are they doing this? And then when you start to listen to the song they're singing, which is about Riley's rape, when they film the reaction of the fraternity guys and, you know, put it online and humiliate them and it goes viral. So, but then I'm just like, okay, that's a great moment. It's one of that. All of that being said, I did not like this movie very much. I'm certainly a fan of movies, you know, going back to like Halloween and Alien, and where the would be victims actually fight back and sometimes get an advantage over their killers. But so that's not my issue with it. My issue is that the film lacks any real style or substance below the surface. It's not scary. It's barely even a little tense. And there's no subtext. It's all sort of surface level message that isn't interested in anything other than exactly what they're talking about. And sometimes that's all you need. And this film does feel angry to a certain degree. I almost wish it was R-rated angry. But the end result is something that feels kind of shallow and softens the blows it's striking in a lot of ways, which is sort of the exact opposite impact I wanted to feel from this movie, tackling such like weighty issues. The characters feel like mouthpieces instead of sort of flesh and blood people whose fate we might actually become invested in. And in the end, the movie is a collection. Eric used some other tools, but I'll say it felt like a sledgehammer messaging. Like there were sort of like these weak scares and shallow characters, and which is too bad because actually I think the chemistry among the women is pretty strong, and it could have been used a lot more effectively in a better film. I certainly like the idea behind it and the take on the material is okay, but the execution is kind of atrocious, and that's too bad.
Okay. All right. So that's Black Christmas. All right. It was one of those deals where it was like, as soon as I saw that, you know, it was another version of Black Christmas and that it was rated PG-13, I was like, yeah, no.
And not just that, yeah, I just wanted to add on to that, Steve, and I think you'll probably agree with me here, is that when the movie does try to sort of manufacture these scares and whatnot, they're basically all moments that clearly from other horror movies that they've been fans of. I mean, there's this clear shout-out to Exorcist 3 in this movie.
Yes.
What?
There's, yes.
Oh, yeah, the scene. That, the
no!
Scene.
Really?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and there's a Psycho reference that, you know, once the movie kicks into gear, I'm just like, oh, they really like You're Next. You know, it just seems like there's no real original ideas coming from the filmmakers themselves. So they kind of just try to make this pastiche of old horror movies, and hopefully that would do the trick.
Wow. All right. Seriously, there's the moment in Exorcist 3?
It's pretty close, yep.
Man. I remember they did that on Scream Queens. That TV show that was on for...
Yeah.
They did a flat-out reference to Exorcist 3, and I was like, oh, I like this TV show. So
yeah, Scream Queens is much better than Black Christmas.
Okay. Well, I was a fan of that show. I know.
I was, too.
Yeah, I thought that show was pretty good. Okay. Let's see. Why don't we, Steve, why don't you give us the initial, subplot of the plot of Jumanji before we break for the news?
Sure. I remember going into the last Jumanji film, Welcome to the Jungle, with such sort of neutral expectations that I was really pleasantly surprised to discover like a funny, energetic adventure comedy featuring a bunch of actors that I happen to like, and a storyline that kind of gently poked fun at the sameness of many video games and how they're played. So with all of the same cast members and the same filmmaker returning, as well as an array of new players, new players for this arena, I kind of dared to let my expectations elevate slightly as I went into Jumanji: The Next Level. They spend a little bit more time in this one with the flesh and blood young men and women who are the ones actually playing the game in this third Jumanji movie. It finds our heroes are now in college in separate geographic locations, but they're all still friends and they're planning to reunite in their hometown over a break. And it turns out Spencer, played by Alex Wolff, is having a difficult time being on his own in New York City, and in large part due to being separated from his now girlfriend Martha, who's played by Morgan Turner. The other two friends, Bethany and Fridge, seem to be adjusting fine to college life, but they're all kind of worried about Spencer, especially when he doesn't show up to a breakfast at their favorite hometown diner. Spencer's staying with his mom and his grandfather, Eddie, who's played by Danny DeVito, who just so happens on this particular day is paid a visit by an estranged old friend.
Okay,
played by
hang
Danny.
On, oh, hang yeah, on, yeah. Hang on. All right, we'll continue this after we take a break here. We got the news coming up, and then we'll tell you more about Jumanji: The Next Level. That's all right here on the Saturday, on the Sunday night, Monday morning movie reviews. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio here in downtown Chicago here until 4 a.m., as I am every weekday morning, 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we're going to talk with Dr. Karen Phillip, whose latest book is called Communication Harmony. And we're also going to remember Danny Aiello and talk about his career. And a lot of other stuff we're going to get to. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We are talking about the movies. It's the Monday morning movie reviews. And Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me every week. And let's get the guys back on. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Steve, you were telling us about Jumanji The Next Level.
Yes, so I was just saying that Danny DeVito and Danny Glover are also, this is a couple of old guys, basically. So it turns out that Spencer, the Alex Wolff character, has sort of salvaged the broken pieces of the video game from the last movie and has somehow got it to work just enough to send himself back into the Jumanji game, but not as the same avatar as last time, as the same character. So when his friends come searching for him and start poking around the gaming fragments, they get pulled back into the game, what most of them do at first, and so do Eddie and Milo, the old guys. So who they happen to be upstairs at the time that the game is activated. So nobody actually gets to pick their character this time, so Fridge ends up in the body of Jack Black, and Martha stays in Karen Gillan's body, and meanwhile Milo, Danny Glover's character, ends up in Kevin Hart's body, and Eddie, the grandpa, shows up in Dwayne Johnson's body. So anyway, so like I said before, Jake Kasdan, the director, comes back and does a okay job putting his actors through the action paces again, trying but not always succeeding to not repeat himself. Once everyone sort of figures out who's who, and I'm not sure I always did, and what the new storyline of the game is, everyone kind of has to go through some fairly elaborate mission steps to locate Spencer and get everybody out of the game again. The primary adversary and one of the new characters is a guy named Jorgen the Brutal, who's played by Laurie McCann from Game of Thrones, who's a fairly standard-issue grumpy bad guy with a bland personality. There's also a new character named Ming, who's played by Awkwafina, and I don't want to say too much about her character yet. And then, of course, returning in game form is Nick Jonas as Alex, who is Colin Hanks in the real world. Did I mention there's a sequence in which some of the leads all switch bodies within the game? So please try not to get a headache while trying to keep track of who's who in this movie. In too many ways, The Next Level, though, does feel like more of the same. And after a while, hearing Jack Black make jokes at his own expense about being chubby and getting old and being slow, and then there's more jokes about Kevin Hart's height. And in addition, the adventure itself isn't particularly exciting or interesting, despite, you know, an abundance of special effects. There's a few laughs, and then obviously a never-ending supply of energy. As much as I adored DeVito and Glover, they aren't really in the film that much. They're really just see them back at the house. Instead, we get Dwayne Johnson and Kevin Hart pretending to be these two guys, which I guess is sort of funny. The running joke about how slow Milo speaks is kind of funny and will ring especially true for people that know someone who can't ever seem to get to the point in the conversation. But the chemistry among the four adult leads is pretty strong, and it needs to be to kind of carry us through this largely uninspired story. There's a part of me wishes that they had been placed in an entirely different type of video game this time around, just to make it feel a little more fresh and new. I was impressed this time around by Karen Gillan more than I was the first time, as sort of the team's strong, stable center. She doesn't get a lot of the funny lines as a result of that, but sort of having her in a scene usually meant that nonsense was going to be kept to a minimum. I probably liked The Next Level as much as I did the last one, just because my expectations were higher, but then maybe not met as much. The film is sort of lacking that new car smell, and the resulting staleness sort of drags everything down with it. It's not a complete disaster by any stretch, but if they do decide to make another installment, they need to sort of take our heroes in a completely different direction. So it's a mixed review for me.
I thought it was pretty entertaining. I thought the first one was fine, you know, and I thought it was entertaining. I think there's a great chemistry between the leads in the movie. The effects are great. There's some very exciting moments in it and some really silly moments in it. Like you, I think Karen Gillan is the best thing in the in the movie, and she's actually the best thing in a lot of movies.
Yeah.
I just think she's great, and and you know, I mean, the stuff between Dwayne Johnson and Kevin Hart, and I mean, that's by rote now. You know what I mean? It's just, they're that's the bits that they do on TV. You know, it's the same stuff that they do on TV. That shtick is pretty much set. But I found it to be entertaining. I was not bored by it, and I laughed a pretty good amount of time. And I thought it was fine. I thought it was, you know, it was exactly what I expected it to be. You know, it was just a big goofy special effects movie. I like Awkwafina. She's having a great year, man.
Yeah.
But I thought Jake Kasdan did a nice job keeping it together, keep it moving. I thought it was fine. I thought it was, I thought it did what it was supposed to do. And I don't think it has lofty heights, you know, its targets aren't set real high, but it succeeded at what it was going to do. And I thought it was entertaining. So, I'm recommending it. So there you go. All right, Eric.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us about Richard Jewell?
Okay. This is the latest film from director Clint Eastwood, and it's based on the true story of the 1996 terrorist bombing that occurred at the Atlanta Olympics. Richard Jewell, who is played by Paul Walter Hauser in the film, was a security guard at the Olympics, who happened to discover the mysterious bag that contained a number of explosives, and created enough of a stir amongst his law enforcement community to keep the damage to a minimum. People were still hurt, but Jewell, as a result of being the one to discover it, became a bit of a national hero. At the time, it was going on television. He was being interviewed by Katie Couric, amongst others. After that happened, the FBI began looking for suspects, and basically just through what seems to be more laziness than anything else, they tend to just look at the guy that found the package and believe that Jewell, fitting a particular type of profile, he happens to live with his mother, played by Kathy Bates, that he might actually be the one responsible for all this. John Hamm represents the FBI investigation. He also plays a character that was there at the bombing. And he is assisted in the press that is represented by Olivia Wilde's character, plays a real-life journalist named Kathy Scruggs, who was the one to lead with the story that Richard Jewell was considered a suspect in this bombing. Richard hires a lawyer, someone he actually used to work around, that he befriended, played by Sam Rockwell, and he remembers him and comes to his aid to take on the two biggest organizations that are here to destroy Richard Jewell: the government and the media. Okay.
All right. Hang on, Eric. We'll take a break. Yeah. All right. And then we'll find out what everybody thought of it, of Richard Jewell. So you guys hang on. Eric and Steve are here. And we're talking about the new Clint Eastwood movie, Richard Jewell. And we'll get to our thoughts on it after this. Everybody, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 4 a.m., as I am every weekday morning, 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We got a Blackhawks Express to play back from last night's game. and much more. Dr. Karen Phillip is going to join us. She is a terrific, smart woman who is a philosophy and sociology. She specializes in relationships and parenting. Her latest book is called Communication Harmony, and we will talk with Dr. Phillip a little bit later on in the show. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, 312-981-7200. And we're talking with Eric and Steve, as we do every Sunday night, Monday morning, about the Monday morning movie reviews. And before the break, Eric told us about Clint Eastwood's latest movie, Richard Jewell, based on a true story. And here is Eric. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, Eric, go ahead. Richard Jewell.
Yeah, so I think that we've kind of come full circle tonight, going from Black Christmas, where a certain swath of people might think that that was too political for its own good, to Eastwood's latest that, you know, kind of gets political in a manner that where it doesn't really need to, because the story is itself is actually compelling enough, but it's, you know, recognizing Eastwood's own politics, which we saw front and center 7 years ago in really embarrassing fashion, it's hard not to, to look at this movie about a big, doughy white guy and how he was falsely accused of destructive behavior by the government and the media. It's just, you know, if this movie was made 5 years ago by Leonardo DiCaprio and Jonah Hill, who were originally attached to make this story, we might have had a different film altogether, or we certainly wouldn't have viewed it through this lens, you know, given, you know, the state of being that we're in right now. But, you know, put that aside for a second, the politics of this movie have little to do with how good the two central performances are in this movie. Paul Walter Hauser, who has been in bit parts for a couple years now, who was so fantastic in I, Tonya as the really stupid body, quote unquote, bodyguard of Tonya Harding, who really thought that he was a lot more important than he actually was. And then he was also in Black Klansman. He played one of the really dumb Klansmen in the group. And in here, given a chance to give a completely different kind of performance. You know, while there are shades of those characters in a strange way, you know, this is a guy that the way he's presented is just kind of, he wants to be involved and wants to be so helpful at times that he just almost can't help but incriminate himself against things that he, you know, had nothing to do with. And I think Rockwell's performance is also, you know, really kind of perfectly tailored to not just be the, you know, the outright champion, but, you know, a guy that, you know, has a bit of cynicism to him, but is, you know, is the guy that you want as your friend. And I think that the relationship between the two of them is the thing that really kind of drives the story. But unfortunately, it's being hampered by the two things that I mentioned before the break, which is the portrayal of the FBI and the media. You know, the way that the FBI's case kind of unfolds here, it's really not even unfolding at all. It's maybe like one role where they just kind of make the leap to Richard Jewell's, you know, guilt, and then the entire movie is a way of them to try to sort of trick him into, you know, admitting that he, you know, did something that he didn't do. And then even by, you know, the end of the movie, when, you know, we know, you know, where this movie's headed, there's still, the FBI is still thinking that he's the prime suspect. And, you know, just watching this, the case, just like, well, how, where is your proof? Where are you coming from a real law enforcement standard, other than just sort of making things up and trying to tailor things to a theory that you have that doesn't really fit? So that element is really kind of borne out. And John Hamm, unfortunately, is just kind of a boorish, he gives kind of a typical John Hamm performance in this movie, and it's really kind of unfortunate. But then you get to the journalism side of things, and putting aside the direct controversy of how this character is portrayed, Olivia Wilde's performance alone as this journalist is one of the worst performances of the year, if not the single worst performance of the year. Everything she does in this movie, she feels more like a sorority girl than any of the women in Black Christmas. She might deny that the character was written or the way that she interpreted the character, but she's putting it all out there on the screen in a 3D fashion, practically, that this is a character that was not very good at her job, that slept with an FBI agent after he gave her the scoop as a reward, more or less, and then took zero responsibility for putting this story out there. And again, this movie was written by Billy Ray, who clearly has some sort of issue with journalists, considering that this is the guy that wrote and directed Shattered Glass. But going back to that movie, even though the blame is squarely at the center of the magazine that employed Stephen Glass, that was a movie where the journalists actually took responsibilities for their failings in that, and it's a harsh movie and a great movie, and this one feels so B-level. It feels like there's no substance at all between the FBI and the journalistic side of things, that it really kind of cheapens what I think is a really interesting and a really tragic story about this character that was sort of dragged through the mud. And, the fact that it's using one incident to sort of more or less paint a broad brush over these two institutions, I think is really unfortunate, and it's really hard for the people behind the movie to defend. As much as I like the two lead performances in the movie, I can't recommend Richard Jewell.
Okay. All right. Steve, what did you think?
Yeah, I mean, like a lot of films from Clint Eastwood in the last 10 years, from about Gran Torino on, this is like an expertly made movie with like a subtext that reveals like what I think is a really disturbing agenda. You can say, yeah, Billy Ray wrote this movie, but like any director, or I should say any other director, would have read, if in fact the way that Kathy Scruggs is portrayed here is like if he wrote that in the script, any other director would have said, we can't say that she did this without proof, and there is no proof. In fact, quite the opposite. That everyone has come forward and said she never slept with anybody, any source for any information. And as much as I'm, especially in feature films, I'm a little more forgiving about facts getting altered, I am not forgiving about the character assassination of a dead woman. And as much as Eric said, putting that aside, I can't put that aside, because it's disgusting. I mean, it really, and I'm not saying the whole movie is, I'm saying that it's like a weird thing that the rest of the movie is actually pretty good. And then you get to that, and you're just like, wait a minute, we're just going to let that go? And I'm particularly bothered by the fact that Olivia Wilde, who just earlier this year directed one of the great female empowerment coming-of-age stories in recent memory with Booksmart, would go anywhere near this material or this character, especially the way she's written. She is the clear, Scruggs is the clear villain in this movie, and for doing what she really did was break the story that the FBI was looking into Jewell, which was 100% true. What happened after that is kind of what ruined his life, but breaking that story wasn't the thing that ruined his life. And I every time that she came on the screen, I sort of braced myself for another round of character assassination. All of that being said, this, aside from this glaring miscalculation, most of Richard Jewell is actually really well made. In terms of the performances, like Eric said, Sam Rockwell, I think, is astonishing here as his sort of lawyer and former employer, and maybe not the best lawyer to represent him, but basically the only one he knew and someone he considered a friend. I thought Kathy Bates as his mother, with Richard Jewell's mother, is really good. I even liked Sam Rockwell has a woman that works for him named Nadia, who's played by Nina Arianda, who I think their relationship is fascinating, and it really deepens Sam Rockwell's character, his relationship with her. There are moments that I felt like pure rage at the actual story of this film, because there are moments when both the reporters, some reporters and some FBI people know that Jewel isn't the bomber, and they don't let anyone know. They don't drop it. They suddenly say, well, maybe he's part of a conspiracy. He didn't actually place the bomb, but he was still part of a conspiracy with somebody else who did. And they just won't let it go because it makes them look stupid. And so, you know, we've seen that story before, and it's infuriating. Like I said, it's a great looking movie with a handful of not just good, but great performances and very memorable performances. But man, its pluses sort of come at the price of a couple of really ugly minuses. And based on Eastwood's politics, and I mean, anytime a person makes a period film, even though the period isn't that long ago, you always have to ask, why are they making this film now? And I guess I shouldn't be surprised that Eastwood is chosen to make a movie in which the mainstream media and an overreaching government agency are the antagonists. But man, going after a deceased journalist who cannot defend herself, is like a new low for this guy. And I'm just like, I'm not saying I'm done with this movie, but I'm kind of done talking about this movie. So,
all right, guys, hang on. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. We'll come back and I'll tell you what I thought of Richard Jewell right after we break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here in downtown Chicago here until 4 a.m., as I am every weekday morning, 11 p.m. to 4 a.m. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We've got a very exciting and awesome Blackhawks Express from last night's game. Dr. Karen Phillip is going to join us. Her latest book is called Communication Harmony. But right now we're talking about the movies, the Monday morning movie reviews, and we'll get to the box office with Eric as well. Let's welcome back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay. the thing about this movie is that, I agree, there are great things about this movie, particularly the performances. Paul Walter Hauser is great, and it's nice that he's got this lead, because he's been so good in other stuff. You know what I mean? Like, in Tanya, he was unbelievable. I mean, he was so hilarious. Sam Rockwell is one of my favorite actors on the planet, and he's tremendous in this, and so is Kathy Bates and Ian Gomez. I think everybody involved in the movie, it's professionally made, it's well done, nicely shot, but... like you, Steve, there are some things about this movie that are unforgivable, and one of them is the portrayal of Kathy Scruggs. And like you, I'm shocked that Olivia Wilde is playing this role. It's also just a bad performance, as you mentioned, Eric. It's not just the character assassination of this person, but also just not a good performance. And Olivia Wilde is actually a pretty good actress, and she's been really good in other things, and is also a pretty good director, as we've learned. But she's terrible in this, and I can't forgive Eastwood for what they did, and I'm shocked that Billy Ray wrote this thing. Because I love Billy Ray. I think he's a terrific writer and a good filmmaker. And obviously, as you guys know, I love Shattered Glass. It's one of my favorite movies about journalism ever made. But this is just like everything that was great about Shattered Glass is not about this. Despite the fact that it's put together very, very professionally, it's acted very well. But I can't get behind this movie. I just can't. You know, it's not like it's unwatchable, because it is. Clint Eastwood obviously knows how to make movies. He's been directing for many, many years, and he's made great films in the past. And this is professionally made. It's well done, well acted. But man, I cannot get behind this movie. I just can't do it. And is there a lawsuit being there's threatening a lawsuit, right?
There's pending lawsuits. They're being threatened. The Atlanta Journal Constitution, I think, is the name of the paper.
They are
threatening lawsuits with Warner Brothers, and I don't know if that's what sparked Olivia Wilde to go on a tweet storm defending herself. Billy Ray has done now an interview, you know, defending his portrayal of the character and stuff. It's very possible.
I think it's indefensible. I really do.
It is. I'll finish up by saying there's a giant hypocritical gap in this movie, considering that the entire movie is about trying to clear this guy's name, and you know, one way to clear the guy's name is to give you the real person that did it, and this movie just kind of throws out this epilogue at the end and goes, yeah, by the way, they caught the guy, this is his name, and then fade to black. I'm like, wait a minute. Like, you may want to make us remember that name. You know, the ads to this movie say you will remember his name. Well, we shouldn't remember Richard Jewell's name. We should remember the name of the guy that bombed the Atlanta Olympics.
Yeah.
Well, I find it crazy that this is supposed to be some sort of search for the true story, and then they throw this crap in about this journalist, and like, wait, where? Why don't you care about her truth? Like, where is that story?
Yeah. Yep.
But here's the other thing. I think it's weird that the John Hamm character is a composite. Honest to God, if they had just made her character, changed her name, made her a composite journalist character, I wouldn't have had the issue. It still would have been a gross way to present a female journalist, but at least it wouldn't have been a specific person who's dead that can't defend herself.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such an easy fix.
Yeah.
And this just feels lazy that they went this way.
I agree. So none of us are recommending Richard Jewell, despite the fact that it's actually a professionally made movie. So, all right, what do we got? Noel, I'm actually off next week for the Christmas holidays. But what do we got? What's opening next week?
Nothing.
Movie everyone has been waiting for 30 years. Cats.
Yeah, Cats.
Cats comes out next week.
Cats comes out next week.
And also this Rise of Skywalker movie.
This is little independent movie coming out next week.
Exactly.
I've got my tickets already.
Yeah.
I'm going to see it in the crazy IMAX 3D. So
and I believe the new Mallet film.
For those also interested in bad portrayals of journalists, Bombshell also opens next week.
Oh my God. I cannot believe the love that thing is getting during award season. I just can't. I don't understand.
Is it?
I don't think it's going to get that much more love.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of the film critics, around the country have been giving it good notices, and Charlize Theron who's the other? Nicole Kidman. They're all getting like all kinds of acclaim for it, which I don't understand.
Well, zero nominations from the Chicago Film Critics Association.
Well,
say.
Okay. All right. Well. All right. Hey, Steve. Have a great holiday. Okay,
yes,
buddy.
You too.
Okay,
thanks,
man.
Guys.
We'll talk to you soon. All right, Eric. You ready for some box office?
Oh yeah.
All right. Jumanji was $60 million. That's pretty impressive.
It's great, and it just, again, tracking services had this thing down to like $35 million.
No.
Yes. It made absolutely no sense to me that, and I don't know if they were getting that number from Sony. They were really trying to downplay it. I'm like, how are you? The last movie made $400 million. They made a sequel for a reason. It was one of the 50 highest grossing films of all time.
Yeah.
And you can say this thing's going to open at $35 million. It was absolutely insane. The $60 million is exactly where it should be opening.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. I figured it would get around. It would make that kind of money. I mean, the first movie was huge.
It opened kind of modest. I think its actual weekend opening was like $35 million, but it opened on a Wednesday, so it had like $52 million in its first 5 days.
Yeah.
But this one starts with 16 3 days. That's absolutely, exactly what you expect for a sequel to a movie that blew up.
Yeah.
Like that.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, I don't know. I don't see why people would be surprised by $60 million for Jumanji. That doesn't seem
right. They shouldn't be.
No. And the number two, Frozen 2, $19 million. It's up to, in America, $367 million total.
Yeah, and it has crossed the billion-dollar mark, the sixth film for Disney this year.
That's amazing.
And they have Star Wars next week.
They have Star Wars next week, yeah.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. All right, number three, Knives Out, doing well.
Doing very well. Yeah. No, and not just in the States. It's actually doing very well internationally as well. It's like $162 million total worldwide. I mean, this movie is well in the profit right now for Lionsgate. So, yeah, this is an absolute hit.
It's a big hit. It's also very entertaining, man.
Totally.
Yeah. Number four, Richard Jewell, the Clint Eastwood movie, $5 million.
Yeah, people are trying to write stories and saying that, well, the controversy is what, you know, I don't know if people wanted to see a terrorist bombing movie during the holidays. Yeah. I thought it was going to do better because I do think it's an interesting story. Even with the controversy, I thought that there would be an interest and that this film was going to open somewhere in the teens, just out of curiosity. But, take Clint Eastwood out in front of the camera, and people are just not that interested.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, he's been doing these real-life crime movies now. You know, he's done, like, four of them now.
Right.
That seems to be his thing, you know, between this and the Paris, the train movie.
Yeah, which had the real-life guys in it. But even that one, you know, which had, you know, no stars. You know, people can't go like, well, Paul Walter Hauser was not a star. Well, you had, like, the real-life guys who were not actors in the last one, and maybe that was the draw of it. But, that one didn't do particularly well either, but it's going to make about twice as much as this movie does.
Yeah, man, oh, man. Unbelievable. Number five, Black Christmas, $4.4 million.
Yeah, don't open horror movies in December.
Yeah.
People. There's only been three horror movies since 1981 to even open to $10 million in December.
What were they?
Scream 2.
Oh, sure.
Krampus was one.
Oh, Krampus.
Krampus opened to over $10 million. I'm blanking on the third one right now.
Krampus opened Krampus made $10 million in his opening weekend?
Yeah. Krampus made like $35 million. Yeah, overall made like $35 million. I mean, the original Scream, which I believe opened on Christmas Day, which is a weird thing.
No, it did. The original Scream opened on
like
Christmas.
$6 million, but that the word of mouth went through the roof.
Yeah.
On that one, and you know, ended up grossing over $100 million. So the sequel came out, and that was the biggest horror opening in December ever.
Yeah. Well, I'm not surprised by that. I remember when Scream came out. Man, it was just so great. You know what I mean? It came out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just such a great movie, man. And I remember just like, you know, obviously that first 15 minutes is fantastic. And, you know, you got Drew Barrymore, you know, she's the big name. She's on the poster. She gets killed 15 minutes into the movie.
Yeah.
And then,
it was the 1998 remake of Psycho. Did you consider that a horror movie?
Oh, no.
Yeah, that made grossed over $10 million.
Just out of curiosity, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
boy. Those are the highest horror openings in December.
Oh God! All right.
But this is also a Blumhouse production, so it's cost $5 million.
Right, right.
So
right.
It's not going to be a success, but you know they move on.
Okay. All right. So Ford versus Ferrari with $4.1 million, bringing its total. It's almost at $100 million.
Yeah, it's going to cross 100. It's going to get even close to probably to 110. But the its global total is still only around 175 million, and it needs to get to 250.
Wow. Okay. Number seven, Queen and Slim, with $3.6 million, $33 million total.
Yeah, which is doing okay. It's low budget, and it's going to gross close to $40 million.
Okay. I'm still sad about this. A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, $3.3 million. It's not even up to $50 million.
It's going to get there. It's probably going to settle in somewhere around $55 million. I don't know why this movie just didn't click. I don't know what it is. I mean, November turned out to be a real dead zone for movies this year. I mean, you think of how bad Terminator did. You think of Dr. Sleep. Midway didn't do very well. It was just, you know, people were just waiting for Frozen, Jumanji, and Star Wars, I think.
Yeah, I guess, man. Number nine is Dark Waters, $2 million, $8 million, almost nine total.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to see that.
Not really.
which is actually too bad because it's really good. 21 Bridges, bringing its total up to $26 million.
Yeah, it kind of snuck in at the last minute. It looked like Last Christmas was going to take the number 10 slot. Not that either of those films are going to turn a profit. So.
Right. Wow. Okay. All right. Not very good, but the box office has been a little bit shaky lately, huh?
It really has. Jumanji, provided a bit of a spark, but that was like more than half of the total box office this weekend. I mean, Jewel bombing, Black Christmas not doing any business. It's just those movies at the top, and the Star Wars is. I'm curious to see how Cats is going to do next week. Are people going to go see it, as a goof, or musicals have done very well this time of year,
and I
think that there are probably enough adults out there to spark a decent gross for the movie.
I don't know, man. Terrence Malick's latest is A Hidden Life. That didn't do very well in its limited release.
No, it didn't do well at all, which surprised me a bit, considering that this one is his best reviewed one since Tree of Life.
Yeah.
So I thought that the Malick people were going to come out at least for that, but it is 3 hours, so some of the showtime, they probably lost the showtime every day because of that.
Yeah.
So that dampened the grosses a little bit. But the movie that did really well was Uncut Gems.
Yeah.
Uncut Gems, which is only in 5 theaters, had one of the best openings ever for a movie in that exact amount of theaters. So this is a really strong start for Uncut Gems, and hopefully A24. I think they're going to open the movie wide on Christmas.
Yeah,
again, a perfect movie for Christmas. to give people heart attacks across the nation.
Right.
And I'm curious. I think that's a movie that I think needs to be a hit to kind of push Sandler really into the Oscar conversation.
Yeah, I agree, and I wish, and I only wish it the best because I love that movie.
Yeah, it's terrific.
It's a terrific movie. All right, Eric, have a great holiday. How much do you think Star Wars is going to make?
I think it's going to make ultimately more than The Last Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not necessarily this weekend, maybe, but I think overall, because that's just the pattern that the Star Wars movies have had, that first one's huge, second one drips down a bit, and then the third one gets elevated a bit.
Yeah.
So I think it is going to gross over. It will easily be over $200 million next weekend. It could pass Last Jedi. I think people are tempering the expectations on it because they don't want to. Because if they go too high and then it comes in lower, they go, "Oh, it's a disappointment." All the Last Jedi fans are upset.
Yeah.
They don't want to do those stories. So I think they're lowballing it right now, and I think you're going to see a much higher number, probably in the 230 region.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see what's happening. All right, Eric, have a great holiday, my friend.
You too.
All right, take care. There's Eric Childress, everybody. The big Star Wars movie comes out next week. It's going to be nuts. All right. So let's take a break here on 720 WGN.